Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. So I'm today's host, Sufustu Amgesen, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Ecological economics as a discipline attracts a lot of natural scientists, physicists, geographers, and mathematicians who generally view the economy as a biophysical system transforming materials via inputs of energy into useful work, material products, and wastes. But conventional neoclassical economics conceptualizes the economy completely differently, and I at least find it can be pretty challenging to engage meaningfully with the neoclassical model of the world without the relevant years of specialist training and shared language. This makes one group of ecological economists, neoclassically trained defectors to ecological economics, an extremely valuable guide to the paradigmatic differences between ecological and neoclassical economics for us all to learn from and develop our argumentation and critiques. So today, I've got the great pleasure of welcoming Professor John Erickson to the podcast. John needs little introduction in ecological economics world. John is Professor of Sustainability Science and Policy at the University of Vermont, one of the founders of the U.S. Society of Ecological Economics, former managing director of the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics, and former climate action collaborator with Senator Bernie Sanders. But perhaps most importantly, John is also an extremely respected ecological economics advocate, teacher, and communicator, Emmy Award-winning producer of environmental documentaries, and multiple author. His newest book, due to be released in December, is The Progress Illusion, Reclaiming Our Future from the Fairy Tale of Economics. And one of the key themes is describing his transformation from a neoclassically trained resource economist at Cornell to one of the biggest advocates of a completely different way of conceptualizing the economy. I was lucky enough to get hold of an advanced copy, and it's his new book that we'll be talking about today. So welcome, John.
Thank you so much.
So, John, what do you mean by the progress illusion? For our listeners, would you mind briefly summarizing the core narratives underpinning how neoclassical economics conceptualizes how the world has changed in the last half century and how you'd describe it instead?
Sure. The progress illusion to me is this kind of bedtime story or grand fairy tale, if you will, that's been so foundational to the so-called advancement of Western culture. It's a story that I unpack in this book. It's a story that's been unpacked by many others. It has many perpetrators from colonizing societies and ideologies. It certainly is not unique to economics, but that's the field that my training comes from, and that's the field that I unpacked various kinds of facets of this illusion. There's an illusion of history that I did a lot of research on, right? I mean, in economics, we're trained to sort of ignore history, to think that the current version of economics is the best and brightest and the one that we should all champion and follow. There's an illusion of the individual, the kind of primacy of the individual in economics, where everything is based on this isolated individual at a point in time, this so-called rational actor model that I unpack and you know, quite easily by joining forces with other disciplines can dispel the illusion of the primacy of the individual. The illusion of choice, you know, that all choices should be made at the margin, the next step, the increment. And that's kind of how we get ourselves into a lot of danger, ecologically speaking, socially, justice speaking, in terms of focusing on just that next choice and its benefits at its costs, rather than really thinking about the accumulation of those choices over time and the impact that they have on societies and our ecosystems. And then, of course, there's the illusion of growth, which is an illusion that ecological economists have a lot to say about, that we should and can forever and ever grow, amen. And this illusion is one that is probably one of the most important in terms of the future of humanity and indeed the future of the planet. So this is ultimately a story about the human project and how the human project has become unhinged, if you will, from ecological reality and from ethical priorities and what to do about it.
So there's a lovely section at the start of your book where you discuss the history of how neoclassical economics has come to dominate other social sciences and influence the kind of cultural narratives that underpin society. So I'm a natural scientist who's become an ecological economist. And I admit, like, I've found speaking to neoclassical economists about the economy intimidating. What would you say to ecological economists like me who've been, in my situation, kind of experienced self-doubts when confronted by the kind of intimidating self-assuredness of neoclassical economists?
Well, first, I would start by ignoring those economists. My number one piece of advice is embrace complexity. And unfortunately, economic advice is anything but that. In the book, I stumbled upon Stanford economist Edward Lazier, who was the chairman of George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors at the onset of the Great Recession. And he kind of crystallized it for me. He wrote in an article that the title of the article was Economic Imperialism. So he didn't sort of hide from the perception that you've had of economists of having this
self-assuredness.
Self-assuredness. Thank you. So in this piece, Economic Imperialism, he says, quote, "The ascension of economics results from the fact that our discipline has a rigorous language," and this is probably what you have encountered, "that allows complicated concepts to be written in relatively simple, abstract terms." He goes on to say, "The language permits economists to strip away complexity. Complexity may add to the richness of description, but it also prevents the analyst from seeing what is essential." So I feel like nearly every other discipline, especially the natural sciences, are trying to embrace complexity, trying to get comfortable with uncertainty, are willing to make the case for an economy that is restorative, an economy that is just, an economy that's based on scientific principles and ethical premises. So my advice to you is don't be duped down the slippery slope of valuing all things at the margin, all things in dollars, all things according to the social construct of economics. We need an economics that works for all people, an economics that seeks balance between humans and all life, an economics that is built for the long run, beyond just quarterly profits or the ups and downs of the business cycle. So if I were you, I'd run from the self-assuredness of economics and embrace the complexity that we find in other disciplines.
I think that's going to resonate with quite a lot of people who listen to this podcast. That's awesome, John. Thanks.
I hope so.
So to the book. So one of the most beautiful sentences in the book is this one that really struck me. It is, "One cannot imagine a more beautiful combination of intellectual keenness, artistic form, and fervent love of justice." Who said this? What's the backstory? And what are the lessons about how progressive views have been forced out of neoclassical economics throughout history, and who funded it?
Well, this was another surprise that I found in the research for the book. This is from a letter that Albert Einstein wrote in 1933 to Anna George DeMille, the daughter of the political economist Henry George. Now, Henry George is one of these original economic rebels, if you will, who foresaw the consolidation of economics around the interests of the wealthy elite. This was at the turn of the last century in the late 1800s. His self-published book in 1879 entitled Progress and Poverty was this no-holds-barred diagnosis of the booms and busts of the industrial era, the kind of beginning of the industrial era, with a particular focus on the largely unregulated, unstable economy of the post-Civil War era in the United States. His writing not only caught the attention of Einstein, but was influential to lots of public intellectuals, ranging from Leo Tolstoy to George Bernard Shaw to Alfred Russel Wallace to even Helen Keller. Now, I discovered this. I mean, I'm a trained PhD economist, and I had never heard of Henry George coming out of my doctoral program. Yet Henry George is probably the most widely read economist that most economic students like myself had never heard of. By the end of the 19th century, Progress and Poverty had sold millions of copies, second only to the Bible during the 1890s. By the 1930s, this international best-selling book had been translated into at least 13 languages, with, according to philosopher John Dewey, a wider distribution than almost all books on political economy put together. But you know, most PhDs have never heard of Henry George. Why is that? Well, it's an interesting story. Again, I said, you know, one of the illusions of mainstream orthodox economics is this illusion of history, right? That we don't need to know our history. We don't need to know the debates. We don't need to know the fact that economics came from a tradition of moral philosophy. The popular appeal of Henry George, particularly his arguments of a land tax that would be placed on the unearned income or the rent on land holdings, this popular appeal of Henry George relegated him to the footnotes of economic history. In the early decades of the 20th century, the fortunes from rail, oil, real estate, finance, these empires, the money of the so-called robber barons, bankrolled places like Columbia University, J.P. Morgan, University of Chicago, John D. Rockefeller, Stanford University, Leland Stanford, the rail baron. And this money actually was used to purposefully construct anti-Georgist departments. Again, this economist that I had never heard of as a graduate student at Cornell. I mean, this just shows you kind of the lengths that empire builders went to construct the kind of economics, a flavor of economics, what we call today neoclassical economics, that was squarely focused on the individual, squarely focused on at the margin, the next choice, squarely focused on infinite economic growth, and never ask questions about where does economic production come from, who benefits and who pays the burden, what are the costs of this system, both to current generations and future generations. George was one of the people who early on said, we need to reclaim the ethics of an economics, and he paid the consequence for that.
Yeah, so I do a lot of work now on England's housing affordability crisis and the sustainability implications of this. And again, I mean, I'd never come across Henry George until starting to do background reading around this. And it, I mean, that story of how land got pushed out of the economic production function was one of the most mind-blowing histories, like economic history stories that I've come across.
That's incredible, isn't it? I mean, yeah, working on affordability and housing, I mean, we should all be reading Henry George in sort of day one, right? Yet we have to kind of discover him by accident.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I've seen some brilliant ecological econometrics, which tells convincing stories of causal effects of things like vultures on childhood mortality, which I'm inclined to agree with. So given the kind of murky history of the rise of neoclassical economics and economic imperialism, what insights from neoclassical economics can we trust and which ones should we as a community reject?
Well, economics has a great set of tools. So I'm okay with thinking of economists as mechanics, janitors, folks who help us make markets work better. But when economics rises to the level of a worldview of kind of the master planner of society, that's when my hairs go up. And that's kind of largely what this book is about. So economics is often described as the allocation of scarce resources towards alternative desirable ends. The mainstream of the orthodoxy has kind of lost track of what the resources are, the means of the economy, and what the ends are, what the purpose of the economy is, and have just hyper focused on the allocation question, right? And a particular form of allocation, market allocation. So economists like myself were trained to use a hammer called cost-benefit analysis. And all problems need to be shaped in the form of a nail, right? And all problems need to be based on the isolated individual, making choices at the margin, everything in service of unending economic growth. So economics has become the kind of conception of society versus economics as a tool to service society, right? To help economies advance the goals, the ends, the desires of the participants of a society. So again, you know, where the tools of economists are most appropriate is within the narrowest confines of allocation, allocating goods and services that are, in economics we teach, that are rival and excludable, right? Goods and services that are rival are ones that if I'm using them, you can't. And excludable are ones where the social rules or norms of society say, if I'm using it, you're not allowed to use it. Those are market goods and services. That's what economics was designed to allocate. Yet we've expanded the domain of economics to include everything from love and marriage to natural resources to ecosystem services to the health of the planet. It's gone way beyond the application of tools and towards the institutionalization of a worldview. That's where the problem is. Now, my colleagues in economics are always quick to quote George Box, the statistician, who said that all models are wrong, some are useful, to which I agree. But there's a piece of that quote that's missing, right? All models are wrong, some are useful, but what we need to ask is useful for whom, right? And that's where this question of the worldview comes into play.
Brilliant. So back to your book and back to the kind of beautiful history of the story of ecological economics. So some events in your book really stuck out for me. And I was wondering if you could describe one particularly significant one in some detail. So the fifth meeting of ISEE was in Santiago in Chile, the month after the arrest of Pinochet. So what was the atmosphere like in Santiago, that conference? And why did that conference stick out as one of the key moments for the history of ecological economics?
Yeah, thank you for that question. This was November of 1998. And as you said, Pinochet had been sequestered, if you will, in England. He was in England for some health reasons, and there was a big movement to keep him there and put him on trial for horrible things he did as the dictator of Chile. And we were at this conference on Beyond Growth, a conference of the International Society of Ecological Economics. I was a kind of year out with my PhD, and we had founded this PhD program in ecological economics at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and we had brought all our students in tow and kind of landed with this aspiration that, yes, we were the reformers. We were going to sort of salvage economics. We were going to overturn this hyper obsession with the self and with the market and with money that the mainstream had become. Yet, the centerpiece of this conference in ecological economics was on pricing the planet, was on valuing ecosystem services. The infamous article led by my colleague Robert Costanza had been published about a year before in May of 1997. That was the cover of Nature. And it really kind of had taken the pragmatic stance, right, that the only way we're going to make the case to protect the environment is play by the rules of the game, play by the rules established by economists. Play by the rules that said that we have to put value on all the services of nature, and their exercise came up with this enormous number at the time, $33 trillion, which was a couple times bigger than the world's economy, and to sort of make the case that we should therefore protect nature. So this created quite a split within our community. In fact, the European Society for Ecological Economics had been formed two years prior, in part to push back against this commodification of nature, this pricing of nature, this monetization of everything that's of value. And so there was this tension. It was more than a tension. It was outright screaming matches at this meeting of ecological economists that were debating the future of this field that myself and my students had signed on to as a kind of field of rebellion. Right? A field to overturn mainstream economics, a field that says that, you know, what's of value in the world is more than just what you can put a dollar value on. So there was this sort of two competing views of mainstreaming this upstart field of ecological economics, playing by the rules of economists, or building a social movement in and around economics to upend its colonial roots and this narrow focus on certain humans in certain parts of the world. So the contrast that was really interesting was outside in the streets, we're in this conference hall in Santiago, Chile, and outside in the streets, there's these massive protests against Pinochet and against the kind of neoliberalism of the Chilean economy. I mean, Chile was a grand experiment in the most extreme version of orthodox economics, right? Neoliberalism that had been orchestrated by the University of Chicago to beat back inflation in the 1970s. And this should sound eerily familiar. Monetarist reforms that included severe government budget cuts, widespread deregulation of the financial sector, unrestricted free trade, privatization of anything with a pulse. the sort of University of Chicago manual for neoliberal reform fit the dictatorship of Pinochet and a kind of U.S.-backed revolution that happened in the early 70s, in the 73. Milton Friedman himself spoke of a shock treatment in Chile to fight inflation and grow the economy. And he talked about a, quote, very difficult transition period that ended up lasting decades under Pinochet's brutal dictatorship. So as you might guess, this contrast of a society of ecological economists trying to come to terms with what our purpose of existing is, and out in the streets, a society saying no more Western control, no more helicopter Western economists, no more, you know, austerity and control of our future in order to export our economy to provide for the economies of the global North. So at a 1998 conference with a theme of beyond growth, this kind of exuberant extension of market principles to price nature really poured salt in open wounds of this Northern imposed neoliberal assault on human life and dignity. The World Bank co-sponsored this conference. So not surprisingly, the World Bank's interest in a Southern Ecological Economics Conference was met with a lot of skepticism. And as was this expanding Northern-led research agenda, right, on largely at the time, Southern ecosystem service valuation. So I'm there going to sessions on ecosystem services and presentations such as North-South trade and carbon emissions, presentation on environmental services of Brazil's Amazon forest as the potential source of monetary flows, a presentation on valuing biodiversity, insights from the pharmaceutical industry. You know, these sorts of presentations, which were getting big audiences, were viewed by some as neoliberalism in disguise. So those not bound by the economic faith were asking, okay, who's pricing the planet and for what purpose? Folks were asking, as the European Society of Ecological Economists was, you know, was ecological economics simply another justification for privatizing the economy, the commons, exploiting the poor, reducing social relations to market transactions? Was this sort of science and management of sustainability narrative, which was the theme of earlier meetings of ecological economics, just another wolf in sheep's clothing, if you will? So it was an interesting time to be starting a new PhD program in ecological economics, to be starting my own career in the field, and seeing this major split that in some ways is still with us today.
I mean, it is so still with us today. What are your reflections on how the ecosystem services and natural capital project has gone over the last 25 years?
Well, it's this lesson in... I kind of circle around to this in the book. In the last chapter, I talk about the idea of radical pragmatism, right? I mean, on one hand, you kind of live within a system that prioritizes economic value, that prioritizes gross domestic product, that prioritizes economic growth. And so ecological economists, much like the field that preceded us, environmental economics, in some respects says, okay, you know, we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're going to sort of go down the road of pricing nature and doing full cost accounting and counting up the benefits and costs of a growing economy and get at kind of a more honest assessment, but by the rules of the game. But the radical part of radical pragmatism is to always keep your eye on the prize of reigning control from the status quo, of overturning the orthodoxy, of moving away from everything of value has to be put in dollar terms. And that's the tension we've seen over the last 20, 30 years, right? Ecological economics, particularly in the U.S. version of it, has really sided with the economic approach, the economic worldview, the pragmatic approach of putting dollar values in ecosystem services. But I find that my colleagues in Europe have taken an approach that is more on institutional reform, more on legal reform, more on changing the priorities of governance of our systems, and not just falling into the trap that the only way to kind of quote unquote win the reform is to play by the rules of the dominating class.
So, I mean, you yourself have worked on alternatives to GDP. So what indicator do you favor and why?
Yeah, so I've had to walk this radical pragmatism line myself, right? There was a movement here in the state of Vermont to move away from gross domestic product and towards something called the Genuine Progress Indicator. This is a more holistic indicator that competes with GDP. Everything's in dollar terms. Everything's based on price times quantity. But it's meant to kind of thoughtfully go through and ask the question, what are the benefits of price times quantity, of gross domestic product, of the economy, and what are its costs? So it kind of plays by the rules of the game, right? It says, you know, it basically is built on welfare economics. And so it's one of the slippery slopes that I referred to earlier. It's a more honest assessment of the economy's contribution to society, of the economy's contribution to well-being, and of the economy's conflict with other values, of social values and ecological values. So we systematically go through, and there's 26 some odd calculations, right? This says when an economy grows, yes, there are benefits, but a growing economy missed the costs on the environment. It missed the costs on inequality. And it doesn't count things like other forms of labor that aren't priced in the market, right? Household work, community work, the labor-leisure trade-off. So using good old-fashioned economics, welfare economics in particular, we've made the case, for example, that, you know, playing by the rules of the game, the economy of Vermont, the economy of the United States, economies around the world have been in a quote-unquote progress recession for decades. In the case of the U.S., probably since the late 1970s. So it's an alternative to GDP in one hand, but it's kind of hooked to the wagon of GDP in the other. So I see it as a transition. It's a way to sort of say, what are the costs? What are the benefits of a growing economy? What are the alternative indicators beyond GDP that we need to get to? What's the new radar? What's the new indicators? What's the new dashboard to guide an economy that ultimately will be more sustainable and more just and fair?
I'm quite interested in what your response has been from the financial sector. GDP, obviously very useful for them to quantify the economy's productive capacity and capacity to pay back debts and things. And GPI does something fundamentally quite different. What kind of conversations have you had with people from finance?
Yeah, I mean, we've had, for example, here in Vermont, our state auditor is a big fan of GPI because he sees it as a more honest assessment of the trade-off between consumption and investment. We've had honest and long conversations with our state treasurer, but the same thing. I mean, she has to keep the bond rating up for a state like Vermont, right? And that's based on our growth rate, our GDP, our income. But she recognizes that that's not the full story, right? That if you're growing the economy based on depleting natural assets, if you're growing the economy by externalizing costs and not counting them, if you're growing the economy by borrowing from the future instead of investing in the present, it's a dishonest accounting for how well your economy is doing. So people in finance get this. People in banking get this. People who run businesses get this, right? Because to run a business, you don't count depreciation as an income flow. You count it as a cost. Yet our national accounting system counts the depreciation of our soils, of our forests, of our air, of our water as income instead of as a cost. So I actually find that people trained in finance get it. Now, there's a big difference between getting it and advocating for different systems. We're finding our credit unions here in Vermont are very for GPI. The Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility are very in favor of GPI. As I mentioned, our state auditor, an elected official, is very in favor of GPI. So we've been able to pass this into law in Vermont, hold it up against GDP, use it as a way to kind of reflect on not just the quantity of our economy, but its quality. And that's been a really important step in the right direction.
So one of the lessons of your book is that neoliberalism became the dominant cultural paradigm through decades of hard work, you know, focused work of the investment by vested interests in conservative think tanks, political races, and funding neoclassical economists, like many of the positions we've talked about at Chicago and Harvard. So is this is what it will take for a new progressive story to win out, like our own counterweights to the Mont Pèlerin Society and the kind of the sea of conservative think tanks as well?
Perhaps. I think there's many, many lessons to be learned. And I kind of went down this rabbit hole in my book of trying to understand the roots of the conservative movement, understanding the dominance of neoliberalism in the United States, in both the Democratic and Republican parties, the sort of dominance of market thinking and markets know best. And it didn't happen by accident. It happened by design. So at the very least, if we're thinking about challenges of environmental protection, of social equity, social justice, we're going to have to do by design, not by just sort of hoping that the market will magically come to our rescue. Folks who are pro-market thinkers know this, know that markets are directed, that markets are orchestrated, that markets are used to fulfill higher purposes. And if the higher purpose is to make the wealth obscenely rich, then we've done a really good job. If the higher purpose is to grow economies beyond their ecological capacity to sustain themselves, then we've done a good job. If the higher purpose is to enrich the global north at the expense of a kind of new form of colonialism of the global south, then we've done a good job. All of these things were done by design. So to undo them, we're going to have to sort of take a lesson from the conservative playbook and get organized, to coordinate, to invest in alternative stories, alternative narratives, and alternative economics. This was in part my interest in producing the documentary film Waking the Sleeping Giant, The Making of a Political Revolution, with my colleagues Jacob Smith and Catherine Goldman. In 2015-2016, we kind of set out early to try to understand what was happening in the Senator Sanders-led progressive movement in the U.S., what was happening in the kind of popularity of Sanders, what were the side stories around economic justice, racial justice, environmental justice that were bubbling up all across the country in 2015-2016, what was happening in the kind of centering of a new progressive movement that was taking kind of all the splintered issues of progressives and weaving them together, building them around a couple of key root causes, around economic power, around climate justice, around the fact that this growing economy, this brand of economic thinking called neoliberalism, was working, but working for who, right? This model wasn't perfect, but it was working for somebody. It was keeping somebody in power. It was keeping some interests above others. And so we told the story of Waking the Sleeping Giant. And I think in some sense, maybe we told the story of the wrong giant that was waking, right? There was another sort of counter movement of conservative thinking that was alive and well. And so far in the U.S. Hasn't led to the kinds of progressive change that we had hoped for.
Yeah, for me, the end of your book feels like you've got some unfinished business, John.
Yes.
After all that work you did to engage community groups, activists, and youth movements in making the film to try and help build a new economics curriculum and a new economic ideology, there's that section in your book where you describe, after kind of all that effort, the election of Trump, just a huge rejection of everything that we stand for. So like, here's the small kind of takeaway, leave question. What do we as a community need to do to win?
Well, the fact is we're winning all the time. It's just not in the bright light of the mainstream media or national politics or even in my world in academic citation analysis. We're winning all the time. The cooperative ownership movement is huge around the world and even in places like the U.S., where cooperative ownership is becoming the rule, not the exception, at local scales. Democratizing the workplace is huge. Employee-owned companies is one of the fastest-growing trends in the U.S. economy. Comprehensive planning around watersheds, food sheds, energy sheds. These are not just ideas in books or in papers, but they're ideas being enacted at community scale around the United States, around the world. New innovative practices around community development, sustainability indicators, energy and environmental justice. In fact, there's a group that we're partnering with called the Next Systems Project, that is coalescing around and aggregating all of these stories that are happening from farmers markets to new banking systems to community-owned businesses to this movement I mentioned of employee-owned companies that is sort of tallying up all these stories. And it's unbelievable how much is happening that isn't being reported on, that isn't being talked about, that isn't being scaled up or out. And that's part of their mission, the Next Systems Project, is what would it take to scale up and out the Next Systems changes that are all around us. In fact, I recently taught an undergraduate class where we used the Next Systems Reader as one of our primary books to understand kind of alternative political economy arrangements. And the students were just floored. They couldn't believe that these kinds of ideas didn't exist just in books, but were happening by practitioners, right? That were happening one community at a time around the U.S. and indeed around the world, this alternative political economy that is all around us. So I answer your question by saying, what do we need to do? We need to celebrate our wins, not hide them and sweep them under the rug. We need to aggregate our wins and pull them together into a sustained progressive movement. We need to stop splintering these alternative conceptions of what the good life is into kind of smaller and smaller pieces of the puzzle, but weave those pieces together into a coherent whole. And that's kind of what I try to do in that last chapter of my book, but I was really shying away from the typical white male urge to sort of say, okay, this is now what we need to do. What you need to do is hear from yet another white male economist and step one, do this, step two, do this, step three, do this. I feel like, it's more of the job to kind of enable the communities in their own languages, in their own needs, in their own assets, to help them realize that there are alternative narratives that support what feels right, that what feels just, that what feels sustainable, and that it's just a question of toppling the mainstream to do it.
I think that might be the most optimistic answer we've ever had on this podcast. I'm very grateful for that, John. So we always finish each episode with the question, what is your rebellion?
Well, you might not be surprised that mine is to reconnect higher education to higher social purpose. I often ask my students, my undergrads in particular, I ask them, what's the purpose of the university? And I get these kind of standard answers of basically to get me a job, to build the economy, to, make sure that when I graduate, I'm not sleeping on my parents' couch. And I agree, right? To build skills and to get jobs and to be part of the current economic system, universities do that, right? But I remind them that that's not in the charter of universities. Universities were chartered really as the foundation to society, as foundation to democracy, to be that kind of bastion of free thinking and free thought, to test the current system, to push on the status quo. And in my field, to dismantle an economics of greed and grime and rebuild a more modest, virtuous economics in service of life and well-being for all. So, my rebellion is to reconnect higher education with higher social purpose, not just to train future consumers, but to really train future citizens.
John, this has been such a great conversation. For all our listeners who'd like to hear more, do you mind sharing some details about The Progress Illusion?
Sure. Yeah. The book is officially out December 1st, 2022. So a little more than a month now. But the publisher, the nonprofit publisher, Island Press, is already shipping. Islandpress.org. You can find the book, The Progress Illusion, Reclaiming Our Future from the Fairy Tale of Economics. And in fact, I can give your listeners the secret code. If you type in the word illusion, you even get a 20% discount from Island Press. So it is officially out December 1st, but it's already being shipped.
It's one of the best ecological economics books I ever read.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Thanks so much for being here today. And thanks to all of you for spending time with us. See you next podcast.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.